G'day listeners, Rod Murray here, co-host of The Wound Doctors, with a quick announcement before this week's episode gets underway. Last week, myself and my co-host, Dr. Fran Henshaw, were lucky enough to be at the Wounds Australia conference at Darling Harbour in Sydney. And while we were there, we recorded some fascinating interviews with some really interesting people. Now, because of time constraints, we weren't able to pull everything together in time for a wrap-up episode this week, but it is coming and it will be worth the wait. In the meantime, enjoy our chat with California-based podiatric surgeon, Dr. T. Nguyen. Hello and welcome to The Wound Doctors, a podcast series dedicated to the study and improved treatment of wounds. These episodes are brought to you by ConvaTec, pioneering trusted medical solutions to improve the lives they touch. My name is Rod Murray, and today I'm as excited as I get because along with my co-host, Dr. Fran, we're going international, Dr. Fran. Who are we talking to and what are we talking about? I love it when we go international and outside our own borders.
Oh, you know me, Rod, I just get excited every time we record an episode, but I am super duper excited today because we have our first guest from the US. We have Dr. T, who is from California, and she is a podiatric surgeon. Welcome, Dr. T.
Hi, it's actually afternoon here in California, so good afternoon to you, Francis and Rod.
So I've just hopped out of bed and you're probably just about to have dinner, but you get that when you do these international things. So welcome to the show. And I was wildly excited when I got in touch with Dr. T because I don't know if you know much about podiatry. Rod, have you ever been to a podiatrist?
I haven't, but I do have feet. So does that qualify me?
I think it does. So as most of our listeners would know, I'm a podiatrist and I qualified in the UK. And in the UK, you do a 3 or a 4 year course and you can do little bits of minor surgery. You know, I might be trusted to take a toenail off under local anesthetic. But in the US, it's a very, very different ball game, and it's a much more broad program of training and I assume a much longer program of training. So these guys actually finish foot school, able to do a much wider scope of practice, including quite a lot of surgery. So, Dr. T, can you tell us a little bit about your practice and your training and what kind of things that you can do, especially pertaining to wounds?
This is so exciting because, you know, in my training, I only know U.S. training. And the more I've gotten into my practice, the more literature I read and the more I publish, the more I realize there's a huge need for podiatry to expand their skills, even to minor procedural skills and even minor surgery, which I hope we get to talk about today as it pertains to the wounds. So in my training, I went to, you know, after high school, there's undergraduate studies for 4 years and then into podiatry school, which is 4 years. And it parallels our allopathic and osteopathic doctors, the MDs and the DOs here in the US. And then after that is 3 years of surgical training, which also we collaborate with the MDs and DOs as well. And then I went on to an additional 1 year fellowship at UT Southwestern in Dallas. And I graduated in 2015, and I thought I was ready to rule the world after I did all of my training.
It's funny, isn't it? When you finish your training, you feel like you're ready to rule the world, and then you get out there, and the first thing you realize is really how much you don't know, isn't it?
yeah, everything. I knew nothing. I knew nothing. I wanted my training wheels back. I didn't want to go out anymore.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. The first job I got when I graduated was in this really deprived part of London. And basically, it was full of people with diabetic foot ulcers. And I would literally be, you know, crying and shaking by the end of the day because it was so confronting. But I think when you go on these steep learning curves, you learn quite a lot of things. And what I really want to talk about today is diabetic foot ulcers, which I know is a passion of yours as well as a passion of mine. Not so much a passion of Rod's, but he's just here to ask the simpleton questions. So basically, people with diabetes get a lot of foot ulcers, and they're very expensive to treat. The outcomes are not very good. And a lot of the time, what we see is that there can be deformities and things in the foot, which make it not quite the right shape. And these can actually lead to wounds occurring or wounds not healing. So what I want to talk about today is how do podiatrists in the US use their surgical skill set to actually help these people with diabetic foot ulcers? And I know there's all different types of surgery, and I'd really love you to talk us through it, please, T.
Yeah, the scope of practice of podiatry is expansive. It can be conservative local wound care, It can go into minimally invasive surgery, which is what I specialize in. And it can be reconstructive surgery. If the foot is completely misshapen, then we have to restore it for functional problems rather than aesthetics. So ultimately, we'll try to heal an ulcer quickly, efficiently. And, you know, that's where local wound care makes a lot of economical sense until I learned about minimally invasive surgery. Because in the foot, it's unique in that there's a lot of bony structures that add to the pressure. And I don't know how it is where you're at, but in the US, asking somebody to wear these huge total contact cast is not really functional for them, especially if they want to walk around and stay healthy, or they have a job that requires them to be on their foot. These things are a hindrance to overall lifestyle and contributes to depression. So the goal for me is always to choose a service that will decrease the morbidity. So that means maybe not reconstructive surgery just yet. Let's try something a little bit more minor, like tendon releases. Is that something that you do within your scope of practice?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is really interesting because back in the day when I first kind of started as a podiatrist, podiatrists could do things like a tendon release in their rooms. But nowadays, that wouldn't be considered in a podiatrist's scope of practice. So if, for example, you had someone with a hammer toe, which is a toe that looks a little bit like this, if you just want to straighten it out, you might prevent a lesion from occurring on the top of the toe. And you can do that just by lengthening the tendon, which is quite a simple procedure. And I think, you know, the trouble we have in Australia is that we have amazing orthopedic surgeons who do really great work, but there isn't very many people who own this space of these very small procedures that actually can give patients a lot of relief from their foot problems. And it's very interesting. I was talking to a vascular surgeon who's quite well known in Australia. Her name's Dr. Gabrielle McMullen, and she was saying that she only really recently found out that podiatric surgeons existed. And she was like, you know, wouldn't that be wonderful if all of these people with diabetes and foot ulcers or risk of foot ulcers could actually get their minor corrective things done with this minimally invasive approach? And this would actually, you know, escalate their healing quite nicely. So just on that, in Australia, it is possible to become a podiatric surgeon like Dr. T. Obviously, I'm not clever enough to do it, so I've never bothered. And I'm not steady enough with my hands anymore because I'm getting on a bit. But what you can actually do is an extra training program after your degree, and it goes on for quite a few years, and then you can actually do these minor surgical procedures, but it's not very common. So I think a lot of these people with diabetes miss out on having these quite simple hacks and fixes done simply because there is not the workforce to do it. So Dr. T, I always like to try and give people a bit of an example. So could you just tell us about a patient that you can think of who perhaps had something that you were able to correct with this minimally invasive surgery?
I just had a patient this past week show up after 4 weeks of a minimally invasive surgery. It was more than a tendon release. It was actually a bone correction where I had to break the bone in order to create an internal offloading solution. So traditionally, an ulcer at the bottom of the forefoot, we would want to do local wound care, maybe advanced biologics, do some padding, offloading padding, or even total contact cast. And those things are considered conservative. But the downside is we are delaying wound healing if we're not really addressing the biomechanical factors that is causing this wound to stay open, which is walking. I mean, how often do we have patients do all of these things that are supposedly non-weight-bearing techniques, but they're still bouncing around on their feet because that's life, right? So I had this patient who came in, started with a blister. He had a toe amputation from another surgeon that left the remainder of the metatarsal bone kind of longer than it should be. And so he developed a blister from golfing. And this blister eventually turned into an infection. And it had a very hard time healing after, I think, at least 3 months of local wound healing. It would heal and then it would open up again. So it never completely healed. So that demonstrated that there was a biomechanical problem underneath that ulcer that was not allowing it to heal fully. Now we can talk about options. What kind of options do we have for that type of foot ulcer? Traditionally in the literature, we talk about lengthening the Achilles tendon through a percutaneous technique, which could be a bedside procedure. but it also could be a procedure that we perform in the operating room. It just really depends on the surgeon's comfort level. The thing about this procedure, though, you can risk rupturing the Achilles tendon if the patient walks on it too soon, too quickly, or there was an accidental lengthening that was, you know, way too long. And so if you lengthen these tendons, which is a huge tendon in your body, if that gets ruptured, then you can create a new problem that is even more devastating, which is a heel sore. And that is far the worst ulcer to have because your entire body weight relies on your heel. So what's the alternative then? The alternative for this patient that I provided to him was through a 3-millimeter incision. I broke the bone exactly where the ulcer, it correlated with the ulcer, and I let him walk right away. And in 2 weeks, there was immediate improvement. And in 4 weeks, the skin was completely healed. No trace of an ulcer or callus.
Wow. And, you know, to the kind of untrained ear, this sounds, you know, highly kind of controversial, doesn't it? Break someone's bone and tell them to walk on it. But I actually remember back in the day when I had a patient who had an ulcer under the bottom of their fifth metatarsal, so near where their little toe is on the bottom of their foot. And we couldn't get this ulcer healed. And then one day they were out at the shops and they fell over in the street, broke the fifth metatarsal, which is the bone that was underneath the ulcer, went to see the doctor. And the doctor said, oh, you should just maybe walk on that and it might set itself into the right place. And that's exactly what they did. The bone set, because it was obviously pointing downwards a little bit too much. It set back where it needed to be. And the ulcer went away. So I think that, you know, we can't go, you know, tripping our patients up in the street and hoping that they break the right bone. We can actually have a bit of a more targeted approach. And what this does is it evens out the weight bearing over the bottom of the foot. And I think, you know, when you talk about biomechanics, this is a really important point. We know from the evidence that people with diabetes get these clawed up toes, the ball of their foot is highly exposed, and they get what's called increased peak plantar pressures, which to the layperson means they're treading more heavily on certain parts of their foot. So these are the parts where they get an ulcer. And it's all well and good, as Dr. T says, to find all these ways to heal the ulcer, you know, stop them walking on it. But if you've identified this area as an area that's getting more pressure than it should do, even if you manage to heal the ulcer, it's exceptionally vulnerable to breaking down again. So I think that's why these techniques are really quite important. What do you think about this, Rod? Is this a whole new world to you?
It is, but I tell you what I'm intrigued by. Here we have two people from the same field, from different parts of the world. Fran, you've come to the Australia via the UK. How wildly different would your training have been in the US versus the UK? And not to be ageist, it raises another issue, which I'm sure is common across all medical practice, this notion of keeping up and sharing information across disciplines and across sort of borders. So, Dr. T, do you have any sense of how different podiatry training might be in the US to the UK and Australia? And is that a good, bad, or indifferent thing?
Oh, I have very strong opinions. When the scope of practice varies from even state to state and then now country to country, it's a significant impact on our patients because sometimes the restriction on what somebody can do is more politically driven than really academia. So clearly we both understand the biomechanics of the lower extremity, but one person's scope is different in one country and versus another country. And that can delay wound healing. For example, in this scenario, we're talking about diabetic foot ulcers, but it really comes down to the political divide that those who have power and control can decide what the scope of practice is for other professions. So I think it's very devastating to see that within country to country, but it's even worse yet because I see that within my own community from hospital to hospital.
Wow. Right.
So there will be specialists that will stop others from gaining more credentialing privileges because they want control of that.
Goodness.
Yeah, I think we have a similar situation sometimes in Australia because, you know, orthopedic surgeons obviously have their interest to that as their scope of practice. And, you know, I think we're never going to see the day where a podiatric surgeon does a knee replacement. But I think there's a lot of work that orthopedic surgeons probably aren't that interested in doing that perhaps if this could be given to this other specialty would be really good. And I know in Australia, we now have national registration. So for example, if I'm a podiatrist, I have the same scope of practice in every state in Australia, which is helpful because it used to be you had to register separately. And then you also had the problem that if someone got struck off in New South Wales, they'd just trot over the border and go and work in Victoria, where they were able to work until they did something dreadful there. So, you know, for protection of the public, I think it's good to have these broad registrations. But I also think, it's also difficult when, you know, we have someone like Dr. T who's got this amazing scope of practice and, you know, she's not really able to share it internationally with people in Australia, because we could sit there and listen to hours by these fascinating procedures that she's doing, but it doesn't mean I could pick up a scalpel anytime and do it myself.
Right.
We keep bumping up against common themes on this podcast, Dr. T. I probably noticed them perhaps more than Frank, because I'm coming from the outside. And this is one: regulation, government, and governance seems to be, wherever you turn, there's issues about how those things are managed. Do you have any thoughts? I hear a lot of frustration often from those that we're interviewing and from Fran herself sometimes about how systems work. Are we doing the best we can, and the reality is there is no perfect system, or do we need to do better in those areas?
Well, I can tell you my perfect system.
Yes.
In the US, healthcare, health insurance is privatized. You either have privatized health insurance that pays for most medical care, or you have government providing it in the way of Medicare and Medicaid and state funded healthcare. However, when we allow the dollars to be controlled by people that are not medical doctors, they're also the ones creating the rules. They're also the ones telling doctors what doctors can and cannot do and what their restrictions are around it. So that was my entire scope of training. There was some good that came out of it, but there was a lot of heartache as well, which was patients didn't get timely care. They had to go through a lot of red tape, a lot of administrative burdens just to get access to their doctor. So instead, I decided to opt out completely. And so I'm a cash practice. So if patients know of me and know what I can provide, want the service that I have, they just pay with their own dollars. So whoever has the money holds the power. And so now I'm trying to empower patients to understand, if they want care, to have that power, they will have to pay out of their own pocket.
And it's difficult, I think, because, you know, especially coming from Britain, where all healthcare is free, people just have no concept that it's something you should ever have to pay for. But the thing is that if, for example, you pay Dr. T to do your minimally invasive surgery, break your metatarsal, have you walk on it to stop you having an area of high pressure where you get an ulcer, it's probably money well spent. Because otherwise, if you say, oh, I don't want to have that surgery because I can't afford it, you'll probably end up battling with this ulcer for the next 15 years because the underlying problem hasn't been dealt with. And to me, that's really sad. And, you know, as you know, I work for Convatec, which is a wound care company. And we have, you know, similar issues sometimes that people just want to have low cost wound care. Well, you know, when you look at the R&D that Convatec do, for example, and we've just acquired a biologics company, you know, that's exceptionally expensive. So that has to be reflected somewhere in the products that we bring to the market. And then, you know, when people say they can't afford to use them sometimes, I'm like, actually, you can't afford not to use them. Mm. And when people say I can't afford Dr. T's surgery, I'm like, well, actually, you can't afford not to have it, because you're going to be using a lot of dressings if you don't get this underlying problem corrected.
Well, it's not just addressing expenses. It is a time away from work. It's a time away from family, from, you know, social obligations. It's your mental well-being. Imagine just being in your bed for a week at a time, and now expand that to a year. That has happened to patients who were never offered minimally invasive surgery. And so you're not just looking at the dollars, you're looking at opportunity loss as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that, I had a PhD student recently who's just completed, and we looked at these costs in New South Wales, in Australia, of treating a diabetic foot ulcer. And when you look at the intangible costs, such as time off work, carers taking people to appointments, it's absolutely huge. And, you know, the cost of doing some kind of surgery is, the incremental benefit is huge against the cost. And I think, you know, that's what we really want to look at, is that there are these amazing advanced therapies that a lot of people don't know about, or in the case of Australia, are not readily available. And people don't actually see the benefit to them because, let's face it, most people haven't spent 8 years at foot school like you have, Dr. T.
I think the hardest thing to sell is, if you did nothing, what does that look like 5 years from now? Do you have a leg or did you lose it? And people can't think that far ahead. Whereas no. somebody who has that experience that sees that every single day, we already know the trajectory of where people are headed. And so we're trying to stop them. But until they can get a full visual of what they're actually doing to themselves, they may never bother to care that much.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that we've touched on in this show before is that most people with diabetes and a foot ulcer of the ilk that you're talking about, Dr. T, is that they don't have any pain. So you're not going to be as bothered about something if it's not causing you pain and anguish day in, day out. And when someone says, oh, you need to wear this great big boot or you need to get around on crutches and something's not actually hurting you too much, you might think, oh, I'll just nip up the shop. It's only down the road. I won't bother putting my big boot on or take my crutches. And really, that's why these people aren't getting better. So it's like a very slow process because the compliance or the concordance is very hard to kind of hammer home to people when they're not actually paying the consequence of pain. So I think, you know, what we can see here is these real shortcuts to well-being for some of these people. And I can give you an example. I had a patient who had like an ulcer that was between two of her toes, the third and fourth toe, and we'd make it better. And then it would get worse. And then we'd make it better. And then it would get worse. And eventually, we just sent her to a surgeon who actually shaved a bit of the bone down. And it was because the bone was a bit sticking out on the side of one of these toes. It was rubbing against the next toe. And that's what kept making the ulcer come back. Well, you know, if we'd done that 10 years before, we would have probably saved her a lot of episodes of care. Now, she was getting her care through a public hospital system, but it would have tied up a lot of resources at a public hospital as well. So, you know, I do think that there's a huge place for this, and we need lots of Dr. T's in Australia.
Well, is it the issue that what we actually need is the medical experts to be running the purse strings and allotting where these things go and organising the systems? And of course, if you take them out of doing the actual medical practice to do that, you've created another problem. I wonder, it is complex, isn't it, Dr. T? I can't imagine there's a perfect system, is there?
Well, the perfect system is preventive care, and we know how well that's going this day and age. So the secondary system that we have is just really educating patients of their choices. I don't know how it is there, but people are very willing to spend $1,000 on a cell phone they don't really need mm-hmm. versus a medical appointment that they desperately need but won't go to because they're afraid of whatever they're saying. They're just putting that at the bottom of their priority list of things they want to pay for. So it's really educating people that your health is your priority and should be one of the top three things you budget for.
I remember when I was a jobbing podiatrist, I worked in an area that was quite affluent, and quite frequently you would say someone would come in with a foot problem and you'd say, you need to buy these certain shoes and they're going to cost a couple of $100s. And they'd just immediately say, I can't afford them. And then you'd say, what car do you drive? And they'd go, oh, I've got a BMW. And you're like, would you put retreads on it? Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. It's a BMW. I wouldn't put cheap tires on it. And I'm like, well, you're putting cheap tires on your own feet. And people just don't really see the parallels. But to me, there is incredible parallels.
It's funny. On a tangent, I used to sell tires, as you know, Dr. Fran, and there are people who would put retreads on a BMW, sadly, in that sense. Is part of the problem, Dr. T, that we as patients – have come to expect, because you doctors have done such amazing things for so long, have come to expect that you'll come up with a way to fix it. There's no need for me to worry about my own health. You'll sort it out when I come to see you. Is that a genuine issue?
Well, I think part of it is when we allow someone else to pay for our medical health care, then we lean into entitlement that everything should be cared for, should be paid for. Why should I pay a single dime? It's on the taxpayer's expense, right? And to some, it benefits. Meanwhile, to others, it disempowers us. It makes us feel very powerless if we can't see the doctor in a timely fashion. And then what happens? We go into their emergency room center. Why don't we care? Because it's paid for. And then we utilize emergency resources. And then we push out people who actually need medical care, emergency medical care. And then this, it's just long-winded chain of problems that the individual themselves may not see that that is the problem. But the doctors who are helping patients through the system, we are exhausted. That's why there are fewer and fewer doctors in the medical healthcare system, because we feel we have no control in helping our patients. There's only so many hospital systems in place with so many doctors and so many nurses that can help people who are pushing themselves through, not really working on preventive care or working with their primary care doctor to see if there are better options.
Let's bring it back to podiatry, Dr. Fran. I'm sorry, I took us well off the rails there. I quite enjoy the political ranting, for want of a better term, that we get from some people here that feel that there is a lot of frustration in that area.
Oh, there is. It's an imperfect system, whichever way you look at it, Rob. Yeah.
So, Dr. Fran, what can Dr. T do that perhaps you can't do here in Australia? What would you need to do training-wise to be able to do the sorts of procedures that Dr. T is doing? Is there a difference in that governance system between the two countries? Are you able to carry out the procedures that Dr. T is doing? If you were trained, obviously.
So there is a training pathway that's been established for some time in Australia, and it's probably getting slightly easier because a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago, maybe 20, it's probably more like 20 years ago, they established the College of Podiatric Surgeons. So this is a college for podiatrists to do their surgery exams. But obviously, when you're in a country where there's no podiatric surgeons, it's not very easy to do your training. So of course, to start with, these people had to do lots and lots of, you know, chalk and talk learning. They had to do a master's of podiatry. And then they used to go and do rotations in the UK where they have podiatric surgeons and in the US. But it was very difficult for people to actually get their hours up. And I do know there was a podiatrist, for example, who was very interested in minimally invasive surgery, but most of the training that he'd done was actually observational. Well, you know, observational is not quite the same as getting your hands on a patient. So I think for a while there was this kind of disconnect between the training program and actually getting your skill set up and able to do these things in Australia. But nowadays, obviously, there's more podiatric surgeons in Australia, so there's probably more pathways to actually get the training that you need. But there are still some inherent problems. For example, you know, admission rights to hospitals and things like that. So if they can't admit their patients into hospital if something didn't go quite so well, then, you know, there's a few issues there. So I don't think they're recognized in the same way as they are in the US. And even in the UK, podiatric surgeons have been around for a while and they are actually integrated into the NHS. And I know one of my first jobs when I worked in London, I actually worked with a podiatric surgeon and I was actually the anaesthetist. And we did everything under local anaesthetic and I'd be poking all these needles into people's legs and then she'd be like sawing their toes off and things like that.
Okay.
And I look back at those days and I was like, wow, that was really quite cool. But at the time, I didn't think it was cool. And now I probably wouldn't be able to do it at all because last time I tried to do that kind of thing, the nerve, I think I had to decide in the end was in the wrong place, which apparently happens once in a while. So anyway, we digress. So yeah, I think that in Australia, we are a few steps behind, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're not able to catch up. And I think it would be really good actually to get an Australian podiatric surgeon in to see where we're up to in this practice.
Because the other thing that it makes me think of, Dr. T, and I'm sure that, you know, as we said at the start, all medical professional people, is this notion of keeping up. That you're doing things there that might be cutting edge. How does that information get shared from there to the local community, to the state, to the federal, to the international? How do you keep up with all of the advancements? The other thing I always notice with everybody who comes on the show, we call you a podiatrist, your level of knowledge goes way beyond feet and you start bumping into all of these other areas that aren't strictly podiatry. How do you keep up in that sense and what's the best way to share that information?
Well, this day and age, we have social media. So what's more powerful than a tweet, a Facebook post, a LinkedIn, Instagram? And the reason why I like social media so much is that there is no financial gain. We don't have to pay to get published. Although the evidence is weaker, it is case anecdotal and so on. But if somebody really was interested in what I was doing, you can just easily send a private message and say, can you tell me where I can learn more? And I feel like social media has that level of power. If we use it for good, we can produce good things from it. And maybe somebody who hears this podcast will reach out and say, I have a well-organized study. All I need you is to be part of the study and I will set up the rest. You know, there's great partnerships that can come from social media as well.
So Dr. T, do you get a lot of people coming to your practice because they found you on social media?
A lot of my patient populations are social media. They're my followers, or they refer their friends or family members or their parents or grandparents. So I see people of all ages. Social media, there's an age range. There's a type, you know, a person who wants to be tech savvy and things like that. And then there's, you know, the population that I'm missing out on because they're not on social media, the older people, the people who really need medical care who have diabetic foot ulcers, and they really can't do anything about it. So social media is just one form of marketing that I do. I also do local networking, community services, and things like that.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's about 10 years since I've worked in private practice. And I can tell you, social media wasn't even a thing then, because probably, you know, most of my patients would have been in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. These guys are probably getting a bit social media savvy, but, you know, 20 years ago or 10 years ago, most of them wouldn't have even been on Facebook or anything like that. So yeah. I think we know it's a really powerful platform that you really need to harness. And I think this is a great tip that Dr. T's given to all our nurse practitioners and our podiatrists who actually do work in private practice, that there's a great way to capture an audience there.
And you speak directly. It's an unfiltered message, isn't it, Dr. T, which is also part of the appeal. The old, I'm a journo by trade, and that's how it used to work. Journos would talk to experts and then filter that information yeah. and then publish it. It's completely unfiltered. You get to say what you want, how you want.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting, which obviously then also puts the pressure on to be a better communicator, which I'm sure they don't necessarily teach you about at podiatry school, but it's a pretty important part of the job, isn't it?
It really is. It's a marketing, it's a tool, it's a marketing tool to communicate well and succinctly. Doctors are trained to talk about themselves because we had to sell ourselves in order to get to podiatry school and in order to get into residency, to get a job. So we're very used to talking about ourselves in that way. Now, when you come out in the world and you want to serve people, you have to flip the script. You have to speak in terms of their pain points. And that is completely bizarre for a lot of people who think it's more important to talk about your own ego, perhaps, than to talk about how you can solve people's problems.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And Dr. T, I'd say you're an excellent communicator mm-hmm. because you do talk in these wonderful succinct sound bites, and it's really refreshing, isn't it, Rod?
Oh, absolutely. And as a lay person, you know, you think that the medical world's for medical people. It's always refreshing. And I'm constantly impressed by the people who come on this podcast and how simply they do speak in ways that I can understand, even as a layperson's the wrong term, but if you know what I mean, I can understand some of those issues myself. So it's extraordinarily important. We're only at the beginning of this social media journey, I think. We're sort of learning as we go. It's a whole part of the world that plugs into every facet of society, this one included. Just 5 years ago, Dr. T, I mean, I could imagine you have been on podcasts as a guest before, but just that as a notion, to be able to speak to audiences in Australia and the UK and Europe and parts of the world that would have been difficult, expensive to communicate yeah. with, it's available, and all it costs you is your time. It's extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Fran, I'm not going to ask what we've missed, because there's clearly about 100 episodes we could do with Dr. T. But what did you particularly want to find from Dr. T today that I've stopped you from asking by my babbling about stuff that's got nothing to do with feet?
No, I think Dr. T's explained really nicely her scope of practice, and we've compared it to what can happen in Australia. And I think we've identified that, you know, if people are able to access these simple procedures that can be done, you know, without too much bells and whistles, we can save them a lot of problems in the long term. So thanks for highlighting that. I'm desperate to get Dr. T back to talk about social media as well, because I think that that's a whole unexplored area. But I don't think we've got time to delve any more into that. She's probably got patients queuing out the door, or she might be ready to go home.
No, I just have my daughter to pick up. My four-year-old is very demanding, you know.
Oh, well, partly it's from us to keep you from picking your daughter up, because otherwise there'll be all kinds of tantrums by the time you get to her. But thank you so much for your time, Dr. T. Awesome to speak to you. I'm really very excited, and the rest of my day is going to go wonderfully now, because I feel so invigorated after my first appointment of the day.
I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you. An absolute pleasure. And that is The Wound Doctors for this episode. We will, of course, be back to do it all again soon here on The Wound Doctors.